of, if you want to be about freedom in your life, you have to realize the part you play in the slavery around you. You know, we can't live for freedom until we realize that we're part of the problem. And it could be what we eat, what we watch, what we wear, but we're, with every dollar and every click, we're casting a vote on the world in which we want to live. And so what would it look like to choose freedom rather than suffering? What would it look like to do things with a view to our neighbor rather than just for us? My private decisions have public ramifications, whether I know it or not.
Thank you so much for tuning in today's episode of Cool Down Conversations. Today's guest is Rodley Sadler. He's the executive director of Let My People Go and the host of The Mercy Cast, a podcast about learning the art of compassion through life's adversities. Today, he gives us some insights into how we can get plugged in to help the most vulnerable and make the world a better place. Let's get into it.
Yeah, exactly. Like the capital of North Carolina.
Raleigh that we need to know about.
I get asked that question all the time, and I'm like, no, not at all, not at all. Like, my father is Raleigh, my grandfather is Raleigh, and his grandfather is Sam. So maybe something happened with Sam? I don't know, but all of a sudden, everyone was into Raleigh, so.
Yeah. We need to dive deeper into Sam's history and wonder what put the hard stop on not naming him Raleigh.
We really do, like, because Sam, I mean, you know, Sam's a respectable name, but I kind of like the unique name. I just don't know where he came up with it. I don't know if he was a big North Carolina fan. I don't know what was happening.
Let's dive a little bit into your background, Raleigh. And, you know, for those that are tuning in, I was able to meet Raleigh through a mutual friend through our church, Church of the City, New York. And you're doing some amazing work in regards to not only the podcast, man. Sharing the beautiful word through Mercy Cast and having some tremendous people on it. We'll definitely put that in the show notes to check out, but also your nonprofit, Let My People Go, which we'll dive into. But we want to hear a little bit more about what led you to that. And a big part of Cool Down Conversations is seeing the journey that got you to where you are now and being able to pull some golden nuggets from that space. So bring us into a little bit of a brief background of where you're from, who you are. Let us know.
So I grew up in Florida, Central Florida to be exact, Cocoa Beach area. I grew up watching the shuttle take off, hearing the sonic boom when the shuttle came in. You know, for me, it was the Space Coast. I mean, it is the Space Coast. Everyone there has this unique experience of seeing rockets go up and not really batting an eye. Like, that's not a big deal. Like, when I was in kindergarten, we went out and we're watching this shuttle launch, and, you know, it's like a Tuesday for us, but the shuttle goes up and then all of a sudden you see plumes of smoke, and I was on the playground watching the Challenger explode. And so I grew up with this just NASA influence. You know, everyone's dad worked there, whether they worked for NASA proper or a contractor. And so I was a Central Florida boy, and I wanted nothing but to get out of Central Florida. You know, I went to the University of Central Florida. Everything was coming up Central Florida until I graduated. I moved to Georgia, then Kentucky, then West Virginia, and then New York for 7 years, and then Chicago for two, and now I'm back. I never thought I'd come back, or actually, you know, everyone comes back. I knew I would come back at some point, but I kept telling myself, I was like in denial. I'm like, I don't want to come back. But then I came back, and it's interesting. It's an adjustment being back, but for me, I had to leave to become who I am now, and so I moved away, and I wanted to be nothing but a pastor. I wanted to shepherd people, help them become who God wanted them to be, help them see themselves as God sees them. And as I was doing that, I had the opportunity to go to seminary, and then I served on different church staffs. And for me, something happened. It was really pivotal when I moved to West Virginia. I was a campus minister at a historically Black college and university. And I'll never forget, one of the people comes up to me, one of the deans of the school, and he says, "Hey, you get the gospel. You proclaim the gospel. That's beautiful. What does it mean to demonstrate the gospel? What does it mean to do justice and mercy in your community?" And this really changed the way I thought. So rather than preaching at something, I wanted to do something about it. And shortly after that epiphany, I went with my students to a conference called Passion in Atlanta, and they were talking about human trafficking. And though they didn't belabor the point, they said something to the effect of, if you want to be about freedom in your life, you have to realize the part you play in the slavery around you. You know, we can't live for freedom until we realize that we're part of the problem. And it could be what we eat, what we watch, what we wear, but we're, with every dollar and every click, we're casting a vote on the world in which we want to live. And so what would it look like to choose freedom rather than suffering? What would it look like to do things with a view to our neighbor rather than just for us? And so when they were talking, it hit me that my private decisions have public ramifications, whether I know it or not. And in that moment, it hit me. I'm like, wow, God, I'm sorry. And that was it. It wasn't this like sackcloth and ashes, me on the floor prostrate, you know, just saying, God, I am so sorry. It was more like, man, that this sucks. I'm so sorry, God. And almost immediately, I felt this compulsion, you know, it was almost like I ate something bad. It was like in me. It was like I needed to do something. And I'm like, I don't want to do anything. I don't even know how to fight human trafficking. I wear cardigans. I'm not going to kick down the door of a brothel. What does it look like for me in this moment to respond to this weird feeling that I'm having? And so I'm sitting there and thinking, I'm going to do something. But again, it wasn't coming from this hero mentality or I'm going to go rescue the people that are hurting. It was more like, I don't know what to do. But over time, it hit me that, you know, God has shaped me into who I am. And so found out that my job was ending. Everybody in collegiate ministry in West Virginia with the organization I was with was losing their jobs because of budget constraints. And so I ultimately sold everything, moved to New York to fight human trafficking, even though at that point, I really didn't know what it meant. But I moved there, and within a week, I get a call saying, hey, can you volunteer to work with our organization? We're doing this big anti-trafficking push over the next year, and we want you to help us work with churches. I didn't really have much experience in that, but I said, okay. And then within 6 months, I'm like, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm passionate about. I love engaging churches and helping them realize that they don't have to be the hero. They just need to be a neighbor. They don't have to change the world. They just need to focus on their street, focus on their block, and care for the person in front of them. And that led me to start Let My People Go, led me to write a book, led me to start the Mercy Cast, and really just provide resources for people who were in the same boat I was. You know, they don't know what to do, but they want to do something.
Sure. Now, first off, I have to give a shout out to West Virginia. My mother's from West Virginia.
What part?
She was actually Weirton, West Virginia.
Yeah, and, Weirton. I know Weirton.
She was actually Miss West Virginia in the 70s. So, but I always tell people that, and I always then preface it with she has all her teeth. And then I tell the joke that the reason that they made the toothbrush and named it toothbrush is actually from West Virginia, because anywhere else it would be called the teeth brush. And I'm allowed to say that because I have a mother who's from West Virginia. So
it's funny, West Virginia is one of those places where they're like number one on the list of all the worst things, you know, like I was reading something. It was like the most miserable people in the United States, the most obesity, the most air pollution, all this stuff. And I don't know how they get those numbers. I don't even know if it's true, but I know this, that when I was in West Virginia, there were a lot of people who some of the people just kind of wanted to be left alone and they wanted to do their own thing. And I wonder if it's because so many people have made jokes that they're like, okay, don't talk to us then. They just kind of do their own thing. And I love the people there.
Just the amazing people.
Yeah, I love the people.
They were the best salt of the earth people.
Some of the scrappiest people I've ever met. And for me being scrappy, like I loved it because you can't back down a West Virginian. they've seen it all before. Wow. You come at them, they're gonna have a conversation with you. They're gonna engage you. And yeah, I really learned a lot during my time, and I really appreciate the people there.
Yeah, we're gonna shout out to West Virginia. We love you. I still have some aunts and uncles there, and family, and some of the best people I've ever come across. And my mother too is the most beautiful woman I know. So always good things come out of West Virginia is my point. So
yeah, it's true.
So in your story, before you made it all the way up to West Virginia, obviously you wanted to get out of, you know, the kind of the upbringing and the environment that you grew up in.
Right.
There must have been a point where there was a call to becoming a pastor. I mean, you said it with such conviction just now that, you know, you wanted to do that. What do you think stirred that? Or when was the moment that you said, yes, this is the avenue that I want to pursue?
Well, it's interesting. So with the human trafficking aspect, that was very clear. That was at the conference, and it came after I repented and said, you know, God, I'm sorry for the part I play. But, you know, with becoming a pastor, that was different. That was more, I was in college. I most likely was already a Christian, but I was really kind of tuning into my faith and becoming passionate about it. And here I am, really trying to think through what my vocation is. And I could not think of anything else that I could do. And I was talking to a mentor, and he said very clearly, he said, you know, how you figure out if you're called to ministry, you realize you can't do anything else. And I don't know if that's the best guidance, but for me in that moment, that really did help. I was like, I can't see myself doing anything else. And I had a lot of friends who are like, well, you know, if it doesn't work out in this sphere or that sphere, I might become a pastor. No, I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. That was my dream when I was 18 years old. I wanted to do that more than anything. And then I remember telling God, you know, if I don't become a stand-up comic, then I will become a pastor. Maybe. I don't know why I connected those two. But over time, it got to a point where I couldn't see myself doing anything else. And I'm like, no, I want to help people. I want to point people to God, to salvation, to peace. And so, yeah, it was basically a calling, but it was very, I kind of drifted into it. It wasn't as abrupt as the human trafficking piece.
Yeah. You know what would be great is if you could combine, and I've thought about this for a while, actually, if you could combine stand-up comedy with preaching, which, it depending on what church you go to, there's some funny pastors out there. But if you could do it in such a way where you're sharing the gospel, but also kind of roping in other people that maybe are adverse to the gospel, I think it would be such a good middle point, especially because to break down walls, I mean, comedy is probably the best thing to do that.
Yeah, I know some pastors who, like, they've brought me to speak, and they're like, well, just be more funny. Just be more funny when you speak. And I'm like, well... Sometimes the subject matter brings you to a serious point. Like, you should not make light. Sure. But then I was speaking at Baruch College in Manhattan, and I'm on a panel with someone from the NYPD, someone from Homeland Security, and I'm up there cracking jokes, but I'm making jokes in a way that's kind of, it's respectful to what we're talking about, but it's also alleviating some of the tension that's in the room. And I was just being me. And I had so many people come up to me and thank me. They were like, I didn't know you could make jokes when you talk about something this serious, but it really did help. And I'm like, I made jokes of what I could. I didn't make jokes of the subject matter, but like, I might've made jokes about the Homeland Security officer, you know, and now he's on my board for Let My People Go. You know, it's like, it's, I'm like you. I think humor really, it can bring people together, and it can also diffuse tense situations.
Mm. Big time. Now, there was an interesting point that you made when you were sharing your story, and it was something along the lines of, it's in our private decisions that can actually play out in society and keep people enslaved. And you use some amazing things, like it could be our nutrition, or it could be every decision that we make privately that can create an outward force. What do you mean by that? Like, what are some examples that we can control, or what do you see?
So a lot of people, like, and I'll just be blunt, like the use of internet pornography, a lot of people think it's like a victimless crime, but they don't know that a lot of the porn that they're looking at, that person may not be there by choice. That person may be forced into it, coerced into it. They may have been tricked into doing this. It may be revenge porn. And so even though the person has a smile on their face, doesn't mean that they're happy, doesn't mean that they actually had a choice. And some people will be like, well, of course they have a choice. Not everyone in pornography has options. And the absence of options is not a choice. And so, so that could be one thing where unknowingly we are feeding this monster of sorts, this commercial sexual exploitation industry where people are being exploited. But we have to recognize that there are people in that industry who are in the commercial sexual industry who are being exploited. But it could be like the music that we listen to, the movies that we watch. We could be, without knowing it, participating in a culture that begets exploitation. And so, but it could also be like, you know, when I lived in Manhattan, there'd be these stores, right? You know, they'd be selling 10 shirts for $20. That's $2 a shirt. And so how are you covering your overheads? How are you figuring that out? Because at the end of the day, if I'm not paying the price, someone else is. And so they're basically, to do those prices, someone is not getting what they deserve. Someone is not receiving fair wages. And it could be at any point in the supply chain. And a supply chain is basically whose hands touch this. So the person that picks the cotton, the person that turns this into fabric, the person that cuts out the pattern, or the person that runs the machine that cuts out the pattern, the person that sews it, you know, all of those things. So at some point, someone could be exploited into doing this. And so, yeah, that's basically what I'm talking about is, what are we consuming? And how are our consumption patterns either helping or hurting our neighbors? And it could be the neighbor we see in our community. It could also be the unseen neighbor who provides the food or the clothing or the entertainment. But regardless, we're interacting with others in every decision.
Wow. So every decision has an outward reaction. The point you made about how you moved to New York City and someone reached out to you in regards to working with local churches, and you know, you said we don't need to do some kind of drastic change, but you know, we don't need to save the world. We just need to serve the world, and that can come in many different shapes and sizes. It could be the person right in front of us, or you know, if everyone focused on what's in front of them, then we can create greater change. How are you working now, and how does Let My People Go work specifically with churches? How do you get involved? What is the process?
I love that phrase you just said. We don't need to save the world to serve the world, or something like that. I think that's really cool, because really for Let My People Go, our mission is to empower the local church, the church in your community, to fight human trafficking by loving those most vulnerable. So we want them to address human trafficking because it's a global injustice that is a catch-all injustice. If you are experiencing homelessness, if you are unhoused, if you are living with mental illness, there is a plethora of things that can make you vulnerable. Living with disability, you know, or just looking for the love of a father. You could be looking for a job. Mm-hmm. Any of these things can make you vulnerable. And really, I mean, we're one medical emergency away from being on the street, all of us. So what I'm trying to do is, I don't want churches just to feel overwhelmed or just to throw money at something. I want to help everyone in the pew do something. They don't have to do everything, but I want them to learn that they can do something. It could be having a conversation with someone. It could be changing the way they view people in their community. It could be becoming open to risking not necessarily protecting themselves as much as protecting someone else. And so we do this by helping people realize that, yes, there are vulnerable people in their community, but that person themselves has their own vulnerabilities. So though the issues that they face may be different than the people that they would tend to serve, they still have issues. And when we do that, we're not coming at it from a hero perspective where I'm coming to save this person. No, we're coming at it from a perspective of, you know, this person might, just talking to them might change my life. They may be the answer to the prayers I've been praying, and they may speak truth to me and help me grow as a person. Wow. When we realize that throughout scripture, the church was made of vulnerable people. It wasn't made of people who were on their A game every single day. It was made of people who were struggling to pay the rent. You know, they were kicked right out of their families. They had made a profession that had drastically changed their lives in many ways in a negative way, but they have come together and you have all these vulnerable people coming together. And what happens? The world has changed. And I want to see that in every community in the United States.
Now, I was looking at your website a little bit earlier, and you know, there's a lot of talk about human trafficking right now. And I think the biggest name, and to be honest, I never heard of the guy until or as of recently, but like Andrew Tate, who is a big, you know, everyone was like, oh, you heard about Andrew? I was like, who? So I never really heard about him, but obviously, and I think you shared on your story that I think he was either convicted or he was charged for human trafficking. And for those that don't know, can you explain what the definition of that is? Because I'm sure it takes different shapes and sizes. And, you know, for someone like that, that's a internet personality to get caught up in such a thing. How does that happen? You know, what does that look like? If you could just clear that up for us, because obviously it's a big deal. And some of the numbers on your website in regards to 50 million people are trafficked, and it is a huge issue in the world today.
Yeah. I mean, the UN, I'm going to paraphrase the UN definition, but they would say human trafficking is defined as the recruitment, transfer, transportation, or receipt of persons by means of force, fraud, and coercion for the purposes of sexual exploitation or prostitution, labor, domestic servitude, and the trafficking of organs. So you see, in that definition, there's an action. You know, the recruitment, which we see very clearly in the case with Tate. It's very clearly that he recruited these folks. But instead of using force, he used fraud. He was in a relationship, so to speak, and he exploited someone through that bond of trust for sex. And so it's very easy for people to look at something like that and be like, well, that's not human trafficking. I had someone from Romania, and I have a good friend who, she has an organization in Romania where they're working with those who have been trafficked. And so while I'm talking to this person, I was on vacation, this guy, he says, well, here's the deal. Human trafficking is not happening in Romania. And he's like, my dad is a police chief, and he told me this. And I'm like, with all due respect to your father, it's happening everywhere.
Wow.
And so a lot of us don't want to see it, but it's there.
Mm. Mm. And I can see that. And that's why I asked, because I think we think of drastic situations when it comes to human trafficking. We think of actual enslavement and seeing that happen. And because we don't see that happen, especially in the West, more or less, it's easy to think that it's not happening. But based on your story and that definition, it can be a very subtle manipulative thing where most people wouldn't bat an eye, but really it can be detrimental in and also, you know, a terrible act towards so many people. I mean, the counts are in the millions.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now with the way that, you know, you have Let My People Go as an organization, and I would love to tap into how it actually runs as a business, because a lot of our listeners, you know, are business and oriented focus. So obviously it's a nonprofit. I think the biggest question around nonprofits is, well, Raleigh, how do you live?
So with nonprofits, oftentimes you're trying to find ways to raise money to do the work that you want to do. And so there are individual donors. We try to reach out to churches to help us with our mission. And we offer resources for people to where they can buy in at a very low rate and get tons of resources that help them care for their most vulnerable neighbor. And so yeah, that's basically how we do it. We're consistently looking for churches to partner with, to consult, to help do the thing that they want to do in the first place, but just don't know how to do.
Got it.
And
what would you say as an entry level, because obviously you're creating awareness around this topic, for those that are listening and they hear this and maybe they're stirred, what's the easiest and most seamless way to get involved to make a difference?
The easiest way to get involved is to go to our website, lmpg.org, and there are different partnership levels. There is the free partnership and the paid partnership, and these are great resources, but that's a low lift. Then reach out to us. We would love to help you think through this, help consult your church to really engage your neighbors.
Now, I got to ask, you must have come across some amazing stories, because actually the other day I had a friend reach, I just met him. He's actually in New York City, but he does a lot of work in the soccer industry, kind of, but he actually does a lot of work around it's what's called the Homeless World Cup. And there's countries from all over the world. I think there's 60 countries that participate in this. And they are more or less, a lot of them are homeless. A lot of them come from underprivileged areas. And they play in this World Cup to get exposure. They're not all elderly, too. A lot of them are young. And sometimes what we find, or what this competition finds, is it helps to discover young talent that maybe is in a bad area and can come maybe to America and get a degree through the, you know, the use of the sport as a vehicle. And he just would go on and on about some of the stories that he would hear from some of these people. Some of them are heartbreaking, gut-wrenching, and some of them are hilarious too. So like, they have such an amazing sense of humor and different outlook on life that maybe we do on the West. In your line of work, I'm sure you come across a multitude of different people. What would you say you've learned from working with maybe a victim of sex trafficking, or any funny stories that you came across that made you kind of laugh at yourself and how serious we probably take ourselves in, you know, all things considered? What would you say?
Well, you know, ultimately that healing is possible, but it's often messy. Mm-hmm. You know, we want something transactional. Mm-hmm. We want to just be okay now, but it's a journey. And for us to enter into the healing journeys of others, that's going to take time. And so sometimes our trauma will brush up against someone else's trauma, or as we are engaging them, it's going to show us something about ourselves. And I think where humor comes into it is, we have to be able to laugh. We have to be able to take a step back, because it is so hard when you're engaging with real life people. If you're just dealing with concepts, not that hard, kind of easy. But if you're dealing with real people, you're going to get your feelings hurt. And you got to learn to laugh at yourself, laugh at them, recognize when you're being insecure, recognize when you're in denial, so that you can keep doing the work. And you will be hurt, because people are hurt, and you will hurt people. Mm. But at the end of the day, it's laughing at yourself when you want to cry sometimes.
I love that. There's a great rule. It's called rule number 6. And I don't know if you ever heard of it, but the rule is literally never take yourself too seriously. And I think the story goes, someone in Congress was, they were arguing about something, and someone said, we just need to follow rule number 6. And they go, what's rule number six? And he says, well, rule number six is not to take yourself too seriously. And everyone else goes, well, what's number rule one, two, three, four, five? And he said, there is none. That's the point. Like, stop trying to make everything so serious and just enjoy the moment and make fun of yourself from here or there. So every now and then, when I, especially around podcasting, all this stuff, and I get kind of annoyed with the technology or the process of some things, it's so easy to get annoyed and just ruin it. But when we look at it, I mean, how blessed we really are to be able to do this and have someone on a call, you know, in another state. Don't take yourself too seriously. So I always remind myself rule number six, and that tends to make me laugh at myself and not take myself too seriously and just get on with it.
No, I think that is a great perspective, especially for me right now, as I'm trying to have this professional podcast with you, but my computer's about to die. And so I'm like running around my studio, which is my bedroom, and I'm running around looking for something to plug into my computer so that we will not have this conversation end. So not taking myself too seriously in this moment.
Yeah, no worries. Listen, I've had people have to let their dogs out, and like they start barking. There's so many things we can do here. So the truth is, a big part of Cool Down Conversations is to cut through the noise and kind of the hustle culture of the world. So this is real life. Like, laptops die, dogs got to go outside. It's not hype, you know, it's not perfect, but this maybe gives people encouragement to start, to get involved. And then, you know, also let me know when you're back seated so I can, so we can wrap this up.
Let's go. Yeah, let's wrap this up.
Okay, we're back. All right. So you're able to share with us kind of a little bit of the past, getting to the present. What are you most looking forward to in the future? And this can be regards to Let My People Go in your personal life, also in your podcast, Mercy Cast, that we didn't quite get to jump into, but I'm excited to be a guest on. What's exciting you most that's keeping you forward, waking you up every day?
I'm really enjoying what I'm doing with Mercy Cast and having these conversations around this idea of learning the art of compassion through the adversity of life. Like, hearing people's stories over and over and over about how they confronted something that was horrible, but how they grew as a result of it. And for me, that's what it comes down. That's where the rubber meets the road. And everyone has a story, no matter who you are. And I love that. And so that has been really exciting for me as I've kind of entered this podcasting journey. Really, like, I've met so many interesting and amazing people over the years that if you really dig down deep, they're doing what they're doing because at some point they suffered. And their suffering could look different, but it brought them to a point where they had to face it. They started their healing journey, and then they started seeing other people more clearly. They started seeing themselves less and seeing others more, and decided to do whatever they're doing. And I really wanted to highlight those stories because I wasn't hearing anything in a podcast world that was really addressing that. And for me, that's my heartbeat. So getting to have these conversations and provide that as a resource for people who sometimes we talk about anxiety, or we talk about the loss of a loved one, and heavy topics, but they always end up in like this beautiful hope, because that's what we're about. I want to see people realize that the world is not ending. Even if they're going through a hard time, there's always more mercy. There's always more grace for them as they're processing what is on the other side of their transition.
You know, we got connected maybe 2 weeks ago. We're already jumping on a podcast. I've learned so much from your posture when it comes to not maybe judging someone immediately, but really understanding that this person that's in front of me has a story. And there's a great exercise. I think Pastor John Tyson talked about it, but basically, someone's in front of you. They didn't just show up in the form that they are right now. They were little babies. They went to preschool. Maybe they got bullied. Then they went to prom and maybe got left, you know, their date canceled on them, or they weren't. Everybody has this journey that they've been on, and it's molded them in some way, shape, or form. And we tend to treat them exactly how they are by who they are when they show up. And it doesn't paint the entire story. So your vision of MercyCast and hearing these people's stories throughout their entire journey and then making a decision and then making a judgment more or less is such a great approach.
That's awesome.
Now, Raleigh, how do we stay in touch?
Really through the website, e.org. And both of those emails, probably the best way, info@lmpg.org, info@mercycast.com. And yeah, it's probably the best way to get me.
Awesome. Raleigh, thank you so much for tuning in to another Cool Down Conversations. You left us with wisdom and actionable steps to get involved and to see the change that we want to see in the world. Thank you so much.